Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Happy weekend to you all, and welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us. I am here, as always, with Josh Wood, my executive director. And today we are really excited about the launch of our most recent project, Pro Child Politics, a book that conscripts 19 subject matter experts to talk about why their area of expertise, whether it is pornography or religious liberty or the economy or taxes or debt or ESG or the environment, is actually a matter of justice for children. And that actually was highlighted to me during my reading time, my Bible time this week, where I was in Exodus chapter 10, and Moses is discussing with the God of the age, Pharaoh. He is negotiating on behalf of God the exodus of their people. And Pharaoh, upon feeling the pain of some of the initial plagues, starts to wheel and deal with God, says, well, how about you go for a little while? Well, how about you just take the men, but you leave the women and the children and the livestock and all of that? And Moses says, no, absolutely not. He says, we will go out with our young and our old, with our sons and our daughters. Nothing is going to be left behind. Not one hoof of our livestock is going to be left behind. That this project of returning to the Lord, establishing a nation, must include everybody. It has to touch everything. It's not just the religious believing men. It is going to be the families. It's going to be the children. It is going to be the property. It is going to be the currency. I mean, like he literally says, go to the Egyptians. They're going to give you gold and silver. So the project of the nation, a healthy nation, one that is following the Lord, does not say this part belongs to God. God, this part does not. We take it all with us. And that is pretty emblematic of what we're trying to do with pro-child politics. We are saying that it's not just matters of family that belong to God. It's not just topics like religious liberty, where we need to consider God's design and God's priorities. It's actually everything. It's culture. It's law. It's technology. It is economy. It's national security. It's border immigration. It is the way that we police our cities. All of it has to be considered, because all of it fundamentally has to do not just with social thriving, but child thriving. So Josh wrote the conclusion of our book, Pro Child Politics. He's been a really big part of this manifestation of the Them Before Us worldview from the very beginning. Josh, what do you think about launch day, about the day when our book, Pro Child Politics, has finally hit the shelves?
First of all, I'm grateful that we have, you know, so many people who are so gifted in so many different areas on the team. I don't know. I can't do debt policy. It's hard for me to understand all the intricacies of ESG, but it does strike me that God creates unique people with unique gifts to share in our book how we can be pro-child in a number of areas. I mean, again, it's just so overwhelming. When you really, you know, sometimes being in the news or reading newspapers, scrolling through social media, it can be overwhelming just how many different ways culture is inventing to harm children, to attack family, to push back on the Christian worldview. And so this book, Pro Child Politics, which you can pick up now, is a great primer on, here's 19 different subjects. You can flip there and just read. What are some of the lies that culture is pushing? What are some of the truths you need to protect children? And we you know, children, the reason we chose children, if you want to put it in quotes, children are unifying. Man, if we cannot agree that the children among us, the most defenseless, the most invested in the future, but also have the least amount of say right now in the future, they've got to deal with our choices in 30, 40 years. if we can't agree that those need to be at the center of everything we do, the way we make choices, then we've got a big issue. And so I'm excited because God did bring together a number of people gifted in a number of topics to hopefully be able to hand to our listeners and people who share our worldview a primer on how to think about these topics and how to protect children, you know, in their daily lives.
There's so many things I'm excited about with pro-child politics. Again, like going back to Exodus, I know that it can feel daunting, overwhelming, and maybe like a lost cause when you are trying to free a generation, a whole people from the clutches of great evil. And really, that is where we are in this moment of our national history. We are facing some incredibly powerful and dark forces. But I do think that God is saying it is time to fight. It is time to contend. And I, the Lord, will do something through you who are willing to protect and prioritize children for my sake. And, you know, he tells Moses, he said, I'm going to do something wonderful. You're going to watch it. Why? Because I want you to tell your kids. I want you to tell about it in the hearing of your sons and your sons' sons. God wants to do something through us as protectors and defenders of children. Yes, he wants us to take back the nation. He wants to do it on behalf of the most vulnerable, for our sons, for our sons' sons. And he wants us to be able to tell the story. I didn't bow. I did not cave. I did not cower in the face of some of the greatest forces seeking to destroy not just children, but our nation as well. Let God do something through you. A lot of us, though, don't exactly know what that looks like. I know that I don't on some of these topics. And that is why we enlisted the help of people that have been doing this for years, people who are experts on this topic, not just, so that we can understand these issues. But I would also argue this is a great way to equip our kids on these issues. I was on a road trip this week, 3.5 hours with my 18-year-old. And for 2 hours of that, we read the chapter on immigration and border security together, because she's interested in criminal justice. She's interested in fighting human trafficking. And I said, well, then you have to be very serious about a secure border. So we spent 2 hours reading the 3,000 words that Laura Reese at the Heritage Foundation authored in Pro-Child Politics. And she came away more committed than ever of saying, I need to devote my life to this. And it was a 3,000 word primer on what does it look like to protect our nation and protect children through strong immigration policy.
Katie, this intersects really well. I mean, you were talking about being with your daughter. I know you also spent some time with your husband on this trip, getting to spend some time with him watching your daughter play college soccer. I'm curious. The first article we have up today is talking about the state of American divorce in 2024. And the article highlights specifically gray divorce. So we are so pro-child. I mean, we just talked about our book. It's all them before us. We're talking about, you know, putting the kids before the adults. But can you differentiate for me why that doesn't mean that kids come first in your marriage, that you don't prioritize your spouse? Because the research here is U.S. Census data. They found that divorce rates have gone up specifically in a group of people age 50 and older, finding that 36% of adult divorces are now happening with that group, essentially those empty nesters. And so I just would love your perspective. You know, we talk a lot about putting kids first, having their interests be first. But can you differentiate for us why that doesn't mean that we make our kids our whole lives, their activities dominate, you lose touch with your spouse, and then you find yourself in this position where you're looking at your husband or wife after all those years saying, yeah, I don't know if I know you anymore. I think we went through, you know, we were roommates for 20 years and now we might as well get a divorce.
Well, there are dangers on all sides when we don't properly calibrate how we think about everything in our life, even good things can become distortions. That certainly is the case with children. If you make children your everything in the sense that they are your gods, you rely on them for your happiness, they're the whole, you know, meaning of your existence, that's where you derive all of your identity, then it's a problem when they move out. But there's a problem the other way where you diminish children, where you say, well, they're nothing to me. They don't have anything to offer. They're only a drain on me. You know, they're the reason why I have to drink at night or whatever it is, right? So we have got to properly calibrate our priorities, our values. And the truth is that when you put anything at the very, very pinnacle of your values, let's just call that your God, the thing that is of the most importance to you, the thing to which you will sacrifice, the thing around which you will bend. And honestly, whatever is at the top for you, your God, is going to be the lens through which you view reality. It is going to be the thing through which you filter your choices and your thoughts. So it's very, very important to get your God right. It's very important to put whatever the thing is at the top to get that right. And even though they are good, it shouldn't be kids and it shouldn't be your marriage. I would say it should not be yourself. It has to be God. When it is God, he properly orders your marriage, yourself, your children, your health, your money, your words. There is something about having the perfect at the very, very top, the infinite, the ultimately relational, the ultimately just, the ultimately merciful at the top that is going to properly order everything else. So when it comes to divorce, we do see people who have not calibrated things properly because they have either made their marriage less than it should be and prioritize self or stuff or something else at the top. Or maybe they have prioritized children and the children have become their whole world to the expense of their marriage. We've actually seen marriage rates dropping over the last 20 years. I'm sorry, divorce rates dropping over the last 20 years, but that is correlated with dropping marriage rates. So divorce has stabilized. There's fewer divorces, but it's mainly because there's future marriages. So the places where we see marriage crumbling is the ones that got married before 20 years ago. The people who are retired and older, and that is still a pretty big loss to their children.
Well, I guess I've always, you know, we talk a lot about the effect of divorce on children, but I guess I've never considered that, you know, in a marriage, there's, you know, ideally four sets of grandparents, but if there is a divorce, potentially a remarriage or a custody situation that, you know, really effectively eliminates one of the parents, you've cut the grandparent time significantly as well. And if that's, you know, as it should be, if that's a significant source of purpose and a significant source of service and sacrifice, you may in some situations have one set of grandparents having to step in majorly to the point of strain in their marriage as they play parents again. And you've got others who are effectively sidelined, losing a sense of joy, hope, and connection that they would have had otherwise. I guess I never considered the downstream effects on grandparents when divorce rates go up.
Mm-hmm. It is hard on everybody. Certainly the adults do not fare as well post-divorce. I mean, there can be a bit of a freedom, an escape, a relief, if you have been bearing the weight of a struggling or frustrating marriage for a couple of years or maybe a couple of decades. But on the whole, this is not a boon for the adults. And I'll also say what this does, because I actually now am in that category of people who have parents who are going through gray divorces. A lot of these people are in the midst of raising their own young children, but now they are dealing with their parents' breakup as well. And here's what happens. That kid in the middle, the adult, the 40-year-old mom or the 45-year-old dad who's got three kids at home and now has two divorcing parents. And let's say this is so common. Right now, their parents are getting divorced in their 60s. Now, mom is having major, major health problems. And dad just got married to the hot new woman that's now just about that guy's age. And so he's off like honeymooning and Cancuning. But she is dealing with all kinds of doctor's bills and medical appointments. And he, the dad in the middle, is trying to both coach the kids at soccer games and do his full-time job, be a husband to his wife. And now he is the primary caregiver for his mother because dad just bailed on him. So what it does is it actually forces the middle generation to be the load-bearing wall. And people are not getting, the kids don't get what they need, right? The adult children don't get what they need because they do need support from their parents. And then the elderly parents don't get what they need. Even gray divorce when the kids are out of the home has a significant toll on the kids and the grandkids.
Katie, I guess, man, this is like hitting me in real time. I guess you can be a 40-year-old child still. At some respects, you can be a 60-year-old parent and still need to look and say, my choice of divorce right now will affect my child, even if that child is a 40-year-old. I guess I've never put that together, that this stuff even applies as you get older.
It 100% applies. And I will tell you the other thing that is so heartbreaking is I'm friends, you know, I probably have five different friends that are in this situation whose parents have divorced or are teetering on divorce. And even then, even when they are virtuous, committed to marriage, love their parents and their children, and they watch their parents divorce, they say, was it ever real? This must be my destiny too. So wow. What we do matters. What we do matters for our children, whether they are still in the home or out of the home. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to put them, the children, before us, the adults. And if you've been here for the last couple weeks, you've heard me talk about our latest project, a book project called Pro-Child Politics, where we take this child prioritizing message into every area of politics, the cultural, the economic, and the national. And there is an area that has been new and emerging that I think has taken a lot of us by surprise because it's somewhat unconventional. It's new, you know, to our species, and that is digital technology. And so when I was looking for somebody who could write about this chapter, what I knew that I needed was not a tech guru. I needed somebody who could properly answer the question, what does it mean to be human? Because so much of what's happening in the digital technology space is blurring the lines between machine and people. And that especially has impacts on our kids. So thankfully, I was able to snag Maria Bear. And she writes for a variety of different outlets. She is also at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview that I think does one of the best jobs on the planet of answering the question, what does it mean to be human, especially from a biblical perspective? So she gave us 3,000 words on digital technology, and she's here with us today. Thanks for joining us, Maria.
Hi, Katie. I'm so excited to be with you.
I'm so excited that you wrote this chapter and that you're giving us some of your time today. So before we get into sort of an audio overview of what you wrote for Pro-Child Politics, tell us about Maria.
Okay. Yes. I am a reporter and a freelance writer. So I went to school for journalism way back when and have been kind of doing the freelance thing ever since and have slowly kind of grown my career over the past several years. As you mentioned, so I'm writing for several different outlets, including World Magazine, including the world and everything in it, their podcast, as well as Christianity Today, the Gospel Coalition, and like you mentioned, the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, which I always joke that I feel like I've gone to seminary without having to pay seminary prices because, as you know, my boss, the president of the Colson Center, John Stone Street, is an incredible teacher and really, really wise thinker. And so I've been co-hosting the weekly Breakpoint This Week podcast with him for a few years now, and I've just learned so much from him and still am learning every week. So that's a lot of fun.
Well, and I love Breakpoint This Week. It is one of my staple podcasts. And I will tell you, there's not a lot of people who can hold their own with John Stone Street, but Maria Bear does it. So it's always a great listen. Always a good recap of what's happening in the world from a Christian perspective. So I want to, you know, just like all the other authors of Pro-Child Politics, you were forced to conform to a rigid and demanding template that I insisted that you follow. You had to begin with the real life story of a child who was harmed because we got digital technology wrong. You outlined the lies of digital technology, how those lies harm kids, the truth about digital technology, how the truths would protect kids, and then how to move forward. So can you give us a little recap of the story that you shared at the beginning of your chapter about Kyle Lyons?
Yes, and I will say that you're rigid format was extremely helpful. I actually love when editors do that. It is a really helpful way to organize what can be a really, really large topic. So I had remembered when I sat down to write this draft, all of these stories coming out during the COVID era and then on the heels of it about learning loss and what we knew about the way kids experienced school during COVID. And I remembered in particular this piece from BuzzFeed News, actually, that was, they had called it the lost year. And at the time, I think I wrote a column actually for the Colson Center about you can't call anything a lost year because the year happened. So you can question what happened and what maybe we could have done better. But I didn't like the language that we were essentially just going to write off this year. We were just going to say, you know what, we all fell behind. Let's not worry about it. Let's just march forward. I do think it's important to look at what we might learn from that year. So I remember another story that I saw in BuzzFeed about a child named Kyle Lyons who lived in New York City. And the reporters were talking to him about his his COVID kind of schooling experience. He was in fourth grade and he first started sharing about how, and his mom was sharing with the reporters as well, he was struggling with math. Fourth grade math is hard. First grade math is hard. I have a child in third grade and I'm struggling to help her with her homework. And he, this kid was talking about, so not only am I struggling in math, but then all of a sudden we got sent these Chromebooks and I'd not only had to figure out the math on my own, but I had to figure out where the symbols were on the keyboard to do long division, you know, and that was kind of a small illustration, but an important one because that is another element added into the learning process. And then also he was talking about other challenges, things like because the teacher is teaching, you know, 30 of us, you know, I'm putting teaching in air quotes, remotely, she's not aware when somebody has fallen behind or when someone is distracted. It's incredibly different, right? I mean, we all know this instinctively than being in a physical room with your students. But at the same time, a lot of these schools and certainly the national teachers unions were saying things like giving out these Chromebooks is the same thing as a textbook. This is going to be great. We are right on track. We're doing this long distance, you know, quote unquote Zoom learning, and everything's going to be great. And that really made some powerful assumptions about what technology is and what it can do, and also what kids are and what they need.
Yeah. And Kyle was harmed through that process. It was really hard for him to recover, like mm-hmm. many of the kids who went through that sort of digital transition, that forced digital transition. So let's talk a little bit about the lies, because I think the way you outlined mm-hmm. this was incredibly helpful. So the first lie about digital technology you share is, number one, the only thing dangerous about digital technology for kids is harmful content. So I think that that's true. We think, oh no, we don't want them to see porn, or we don't want them to like stumble upon, you know, some kind of like rabbit hole of extremism. But you're mm-hmm. saying when it comes to kids, that's actually not the real concern. So what's the right. lie there?
It's certainly a concern. I think the lie is that that's the only or even the major concern, because a lot of time when you bring up things like regulating digital tech for kids or even thinking better about it politically, people will automatically go here and they'll say, oh, we need age limits, we need parental controls. All those things can be good and have their place. The problem is if you think that's the only problem, then you're ignoring the fact that, and I think I quoted Jonathan Haidt, who has written, of course, extensively about this, especially in The Anxious Generation, which is his recent book. He writes that digital technology is actually changing the nature of childhood itself. So it's not just what kids see, it's how using the tech makes them think about themselves and think about the world. And that change is not necessarily for the better.
Okay, that feeds right into lie number two, which is that digital technology can educate. And like for all of us parents who are like, oh, I got this in this educational app. And oh, well, you know, now they're doing their, you know, right. fourth grade social studies online or in this, you know, you're saying you're not even sure if digital tech can educate. So what do you mean by that?
So first and foremost, there is sort of a digital Wild West, and I'm not the one who coined that phrase, but other cultural commentators have talked about this when it comes to educational apps or even software that wants to call itself educational. There is very little regulation about who gets to claim that moniker and what it has to mean. And I actually listened to a digital tech podcast about this, where they said that over 70% of the apps labeled educational, or the apps in the literacy space, let's say, over 70% are basically letter recognition apps. So this is like, you know, the little videos in Sesame Street where the letters dance around and the kids learn to identify the letters. That's meaningful. But that doesn't mean that kids are learning to read on that app. That is one very, very small part of educating a kid. But when you look at that and you say that, you know, 70 whatever odd percent of the apps out there that are calling themselves literacy apps really aren't teaching literacy. That is really important to note. The other thing is that we know that human beings are minds, but we are also bodies. And we know there's so much data on this that we learn best when we're engaging not just one of those things, but both of them. Too often, digital technology in the education space is only concerned with engaging the mind. So we know, for example, when you read something on a physical piece of paper or when you write something with your physical hand, you're going to remember it for longer, and you're going to retain more of that information as opposed to reading it digitally or typing. And I think for a lot of sectors of especially the public education system, when technology has become available, our gut instinct is faster and more efficient is better. And so let's teach kids to type. Let's read this online. Let's take these tests online. But that just doesn't teach our brains as well as doing things physically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as a mother who spends, 50% of her life registering children for things, I can say that I feel like the digital world has made it maybe too easy to just be like, oh, since we can get their attention by this and we don't have to send a piece of paper. I mean, like, I just feel like I'm consumed with online, giving and receiving of information. And I don't feel like I have a simpler life than my mother did, who was completely analog,
Right.
And then it sort of feeds into your last lie, which I really think is sort of the crux of the issue, Erin. It is, mm-hmm. if we can do something, we should do it. So why is that a lie?
Because that doesn't take into account exactly what you said at the top of this, Katie, which is what does it mean to be human? So if the end goal of our lives was to have as much comfort and low stress, the least amount of suffering possible, then I suppose we would be closer to saying, sure, if we can do something, then we should do it. But that is not the end goal of life. And actually, we know that endeavoring to only minimize suffering or only minimize challenge and only do things as efficiently and easily as possible, that does not lead to human flourishing or even human happiness and satisfaction. It's the challenge of life, the stresses of life often, the difficulties, the difficult relationships that lead to the deepest satisfaction and deepest flourishing. So how does this relate to education? Well, when you're talking about technology, a lot of times the selling points for the tech is exactly what I said at the beginning, which is it's easier. Or it's simpler, and one of the examples that I shared in here was I kind of went down this rabbit hole when I was researching this chapter about the calculator, and when the graphing calculator really hit the scene in the late 70s, and just in about 10 years after the calculator, the graphing calculator that could do some advanced trigonometry and calculus on the screen, hit the market. I mean a lot of the teachers' unions or even just the teachers' organizations had successfully lobbied to get this to be standard in all public school classrooms. That's another big part of this conversation, which is the influence of the tech companies themselves and the lobbyists. But once that was standard in all these classrooms, about 10 years go by, this group of calculus mathematicians met for an annual conference that they have, and they announced something called the Calculus Reform Movement. I don't see a lot of evidence that it went anywhere necessarily, but they wrote sort of this manifesto, and the main thing they said was, because of these calculators, our kids know how to perform the rote duties of certain equations, but they cannot explain why. They don't actually understand the calculus. They understand they can do the shortcut. They know how to, push this button and then that one and that sequence. And that is certainly its own kind of learning. But in other areas of life, we don't teach the shortcut first. We teach the long way first and the why behind it. And then you can learn the shortcut. And that's sort of a microcosm view of what technology and education can do if our first and foremost goal is, if we can, we should.
Mm-hmm. And you do a great job in sort of detailing the harms of each of those lies as it relates especially to kids. You go on to detail the truth. What is the truth about digital technology? You have two main points. I'm going to list both of them, and then you can hit whichever one you want, because you've kind of touched on a lot of this already. Mm-hmm. Truth number one. Digital technology can't match the benefits of an embodied childhood. And then truth number two, helping kids use digital technology well requires asking a few key questions first. Yes. So where do you want to go with that? Like what truth do you feel like if someone could walk away from this radio program with one of those truths, what would you want them to know about it?
I think actually the crux of the chapter is that first one, that digital technology can't match the benefits of an embodied childhood. This again gets back to what it means to be human, which means, among other things, being a mind and a body and a soul. And a lot of times the digital technology, not just in the education space, but everywhere right now that we're sold, comes with this promise that it can either replace or meaningfully replicate what is a human or even a physical experience. And that is a lie. There's just no way to do that, which points to, you know, there are other areas of culture right now. You know, I know you talk in this book about gender and sexuality, for example, where there is a certain drive to disconnect our minds from our bodies, that our bodies are just kind of this baggage that we can do whatever we want with. And that's just not true. And learning is a great way to look at that. And so is digital technology, because unless we engage our bodies in the way that we were designed to engage them, then we're not going to learn and we're not going to flourish the way that we can. In terms of the questions that we should ask first, I mean, this is one of those things where what I appreciated about your outline for these chapters as well was this was not a chapter that was claiming that digital technology is of the devil or we'd have to avoid it at all costs and it's terrible and it's only bad and, you know, the best parents are the ones that shield their kids entirely. We're not down on digital technology. It's just putting it in its proper place. And so I think some of those questions are, does this tech offer something that we lack? So for example, like these digital, the Google Translate is an incredible device. There's another app called Wordly that my church uses that automatically translates my pastor's sermon into other languages as he's preaching, which is incredible.
I'm going to have to pause there because we are almost out of time, but we've been talking with Maria Bayer. She authored the digital technology chapter of Pro Child Politics. Go and read it and then dive in and search for her and all the other places she writes, because she is a fount of what it means to be human wisdom. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
I hope that you enjoyed that conversation with Maria Bayer. She really does a great job of bringing to light exactly why some of these technologies, some of the advancements that we are making in the digital space are not necessarily good for kids. And it's an example of how we need to start looking at everything through the lens of putting kids first, not just because we can do it, we should do it, but really, what is it that we need to do to protect children? So that has implications when we think about emerging technologies, but it also has implications when we look at our own lives, our own social circles, our own personal decisions. So that's what we try to tackle in the last segment of Them Before Us Radio. How do these child protection principles, what do they look like in our own lives? So I have my training director, Jen Friesen, here, who is going to pitch a few questions that we've received this week from you, the listener. Welcome back, Jen.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me. We have a really interesting question that came from some folks that have adopted a number of siblings out of foster care. So they adopted one and then a sibling would come along because of the choices of the parents. So they'd be half siblings or full siblings. And the question is, knowing that the connection with birth mom and dad is so important, but sometimes that can be lost, how important is it to maintain biological sibling connections? Like if you already have adopted some kids that are biologically related, and now you know there's another one available, how hard should you work to maintain those connections?
Oh, that's a very good question. And obviously, there are going to be so many factors on the ground that I don't know a whole lot. I have not adopted sibling groups through foster care. I have not worked in the foster care world. I've worked in the world of international adoption, which is distinct often because it's not a sibling group that is available. But I do know enough to know that those situations are very complex because sometimes they are not full biological siblings. They are half siblings. Sometimes there's different family considerations for one child versus the other child. But I will say, just from the perspective of children themselves, that the children tend to say that those relationships matter to them. And that is why there has been a trend within the foster care world to try and keep siblings together whenever possible, to try to find somebody who can take all three or you know, if there's more, like at least maintain those connections. And we see this also in the world of reproductive technologies where children also have tens, dozens, sometimes hundreds of half siblings in the case of a prolific sperm donor. And in our first book, Them Before Us, we profiled the stories of children who were separated from a mother or father, sometimes through adoption, sometimes through reproductive technologies. And it was really interesting to me because there were some kids who were created using sperm donor or egg donor who said, I don't necessarily need to know the identity of my donor. I feel like my loving mother and father really satisfied that need for me. But I'm so curious and I really want to know my siblings and my half siblings. Like that actually is more important to me than knowing my own, you know, genetic mother or father. So I think that as much as possible, contact, knowledge of, but it is pretty important for the kids themselves to know and have connections with their biological siblings whenever possible. One other note on that is I do and have read stories of children who were adopted and separated from a biological sibling and then are reunited later and how sweet that is for them, or they were adopted to two different places and the massive disparity in the living arrangements were either challenging for the sake of, oh, wow, they had it so rough and their placement was not as stable or secure as mine, or, oh, my gosh, I lived through this and they got that kind of arrangement. What was wrong with me that I also was not chosen by that family? So whenever possible, yes, prioritize keeping sibling groups together or at least connected. But I know that with the complexities of the foster care system, sometimes that's not possible.
Yeah, I think when you can't, it's not always feasible maybe to have them come into your house, who knows, with other siblings you have or other challenges. But like you said, the connection and your children and that child knowing you care about them knowing each other, I think is really valuable. Okay, next question. This is from James. Is it wrong to have children if your own genetic issues could be passed down to them? You know, a lot of people now, all the different technology, you can be aware, here's the chances I could pass something that's potentially life-threatening or very dangerous, or they won't have a good, you know, people will say quality of life, or they won't live very long. Mm-hmm. Is it ethically wrong then to have children?
I want to hear your response on this too, Jen, because you've had a lot of experience working with populations that the world would say, hey, they probably shouldn't be here. You know, you've worked with a lot of special needs kids, sometimes severely special needs kids. And the Christian worldview here does something that no other worldview does, which is completely dignify every kind of life, every level of development and ability in a way that really no other worldview does. And so I would say, you know, was your life unworthy to be lived? You have a genetic connection. Was your life unworthy to be lived? Because that's really what you're asking is, should I create a child or have children if they have the possibility of being like me? And the answer is, of course you should, because you also are worthy of life. Sometimes those kinds of genetic disabilities will get in the way of fertility, will stop you from reproducing. And that is a very hard cross to bear, because you, like most people, probably really long to be a father or a mother and probably would be a wonderful father or mother. So sometimes that's out of our control. But I would say in the area of making life and certainly in the area of taking life, that's actually completely outside of our zone of responsibility. We are now crossing into God's business. And there's always dangers for Christians when we try to step into God's lane. Our lane is, are we living virtuously? Are we doing whatever we can to make ourselves healthy so that we can be mothers or fathers or get to the point where we're resolving any kind of fertility issues that we're having, that kind of thing. But then what will happen if I conceive? At that point, what are you doing? Playing the odds ratio? I mean, that's insanity. God will play those odds ratios for you. You fully live yourself devoted to him and know that even if you do have a child and even if they do have a genetic condition, they are perfectly made in the image of God. And they also have a parent who will help them navigate that challenge in a way that probably no other parent could.
Right. That, I mean, kind of goes to the deepest question in the Christian worldview is why is there suffering or why does God allow suffering? And really that question is almost saying, should I have children if they're going to suffer? And the bad news is all your children are going to suffer somehow because suffering is a part of the human experience. There will be really challenging things and there will be easy things maybe for every kind of life that lives. And to your point, God has a purpose for every human life. And, you know, I saw some stories recently, people replying to tweets talking about children they had had that were going to die right away, because that's some of the abortion argument right now. Well, if the baby's going to die, you should kill it in the womb earlier. And they were sharing beautiful stories of, we had 48 hours with our daughter and then she died. We knew she was going to die, and how beautiful it was. What an impact she made on us. And I think that's missing from our secular culture, that idea of life is beautiful regardless of the many ways that it is lived or experienced, right?
Yeah. So I would say your line of demarcation here is, what's your business and what's God's business? You do your business well, full extent, all out in terms of virtue, righteousness, health, and then don't you touch God's business. Mm-hmm. That's not yours.
All right. Third question. This was someone who listened to your first episode of the radio program. You mentioned that children have always been attacked and killed historically. Could you give examples other than the one with Moses and the midwives from the Bible? Have other nations done this?
And yes, that's a great question. I'm so glad that we have the chance to clarify. I'm not saying that everybody all throughout history has always victimized children. I think that because of the nature of the parent-child relationship and the deep protective bonds that people tend to have for their own children, that marriage and family has been the most child-friendly institution the world has ever known for that reason, because there is this innate protectiveness that parents have for their own children. But there are systems and there are cultures that routinely, and I would say the norm has been, to denigrate and treat children as less than. You know, the one I talk about the most is the pagan world into which the church was born, that did not necessarily consider children to be fully human until they could walk or talk. Very often, the disabled children or the female children were left to be exposed to the elements, that is, just left to die and that, you know, for wild animals to take them or thrown in the river or whatever that is. They were absolutely treated as sexual objects for the gratification of the free men, not the slave men, not the free women, the free men. And this was the norm. I mean, that Christianity would say these are actually image bearers from the moment of conception. So we're not going to abort, we're not going to expose, we're not going to sexualize, we're not going to sell our children. So radically different from the culture that those children were born into. And thank God, Christianity spread throughout much of the known world. And everywhere that it went, it dignified children and elevated their status in the world. And now we have things like the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child that I would say even goes too far in terms of defining what is and is not a child right, but recognize this child dignifying perspective and requires that we protect them on the national level and the international level. We take this as the default. Kids are precious. They're worthy of protection. That is not and has not been the historic reality throughout much of human civilization.
Well, and it was a pretty quick internet search to see, you know, what other civilizations or nations have done killing children. Well, and putting aside that we're doing it right now to a point that has not been done in history, right? Mass scale in the West with abortion. But I pulled up some really disturbing things. Peru, I think this was 2018 from National Geographic, found 140 sacrificed children from ages 5 to 14. Evidence their, you know, chests had been cut open, kind of thing. So, and the way that they know that these were intentional killings at some level is the bodies are positioned very carefully with a lot of precious things set around them in a certain way. It shows that it was ritual. It was sacrifice. It wasn't, or, you know, even some of the injuries, blunt head trauma, chest cut open. It wasn't, a sword through the stomach, something that would be the result of war that took a lot of children. And we pulled up Mayan culture, Aztec culture. I found an article from the ancient Near East, children buried, skeletons and such in Turkey. So we do see throughout history, children have often paid the price for whatever the religious practices. We want good, we need rain. So there's children that get sacrificed for that.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking back, I was actually just listening to an episode of our radio show because I'm trying to like, how'd that sound? How'd that go? What did that come off like? And the conversation that we had a couple weeks ago with Chris Barnard, who wrote the environment chapter in our Pro-Child Politics book, he talks about how, you know, there really is some of the people that are advocating for good, responsible environmental policy are doing it with pure motives, and they really do want to protect the earth, and they're not anti-human. But There are segments, especially of the elite, that are pulling the levers on a lot of our environmental and energy policy that have a truly anti-human worldview. They generally, well, they'll just openly say, we want depopulation. There should be fewer people on the planet. And that is a absolutely religious instinct. Like that is a religious impulse to say, humans are bad. We should not have them. We should eliminate them. And it's very interesting to me that it's always somebody else that has to die. It's never the guy who's talking. It's not the one flying the private jet. It's the African children that need to be subjected to abortion, or it is the third world women that need to have birth control forced upon them, or they're not going to get the US aid or whatever it is. That we really have, we believe ourselves to be better than those pagans and those Mayans. But we ourselves are sitting atop a pile of dead children, whether it's from the abortion industry or the IVF industry.
Well, and we've talked about, I think Ali B. Stuckey mentions this idea that when you reorient what we worship, so if there's no external being, there's no creator, all powerful being we're going to worship, we have to worship something else. So a lot of people then might worship children. You elevate them to God, or you worship your own sexual desire, proclivity, or we're worshiping earth, or we're worshiping animals, right? But they're never, if they're not in the right order, then other things always are going to come into play. And I love that conversation with Chris Bernard talking about preservation is nobody's allowed to touch it. We have to keep the earth exact the way it's supposed to be. Conservation means taking care of it for human flourishing, which is the point. And that's what Christians should be doing.
Well, and you've gotten right to the heart of this matter. And that is, don't believe that you are not going to have anything that rules you. Like, you will have a God. Your God might be your stomach. Your God might be your urges. Your God might be money. Your God might be social approval, but something will be your God. And like, if I just wanted to use sort of Jordan Peterson speak for that, your God is just the thing at the top of your hierarchy of values. It's the primary thing in your life. And like you said, good things can be gods too. Like if my marriage is the ultimate thing, everything's going to bow down to that, really to the point of kind of destroying the other things I need to be taking care of in my life. Children can be your God in the sense of if they're at their very, very, very top, that usually leads to somewhat distorted approaches to parenting, for example. So really, if we are serious about our marriage, our bodies, our children, we have to have our gods properly ordered. And the amazing thing is when you put God, the God of the Bible, at the very, very top, everything else gets the kind of protection and attention that it deserves. That is certainly true when it comes to child protection. Those of us who are believers put God at the top, and as a result, children will be protected. It is so important for Christians to get this right, to make sure that God is at the top of our hierarchy, because when he is, the trickle down is rightly ordered marriage, children, and everything else in this life. Thanks again for joining us. We will see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.